This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. Amy Edmondson is one of the world's most influential organisational psychologists, a professor at Harvard Business School, and an expert on the concept of psychological safety. She joined us to answer a simple, provocative question. What if it's only by learning to fail that we can truly hope to succeed? Her new book, Right Kind of Wrong, doesn't tell us that failure is a problem, but it also doesn't tell us to fail fast, fail often. It tells us to fail well. She joined Hannah McInnes a couple of weeks ago to share more.
Can I start by just asking, what perception of failure that society upholds is this book a response to?
Very good question. So, on average, society upholds an idea about failure, and not necessarily consciously all the time, but partly unconsciously, that it's bad, that it's shameful. We have, all of us, I think, an instinctive aversion to failure. We want to succeed, not fail. We want to look good, not bad. And so sometimes we'll just do just about anything not to fail, or at least not to look as if we're failing.
Do you think that that is still very much the case? It sort of seems to me that it's changing, that there is a narrative that's more encouraging of failure, that understands, you know, fail to succeed is becoming something that people are starting to talk about. Or do you think that that is just something that's a narrative with not much depth to it?
Okay, let's get to it, right? Because you're absolutely right. And that is why I wrote the book, because there is much more messaging out there about failure is good, fail fast, you know, succeed sooner. And of course, these aren't new messages. People as long ago as you know, Thomas Edison, or even, you know, thousands of years ago, understood that you will often have to fail on the way to success, and that very few real successes come about without some failures along the way. So the main thing I'm trying to do with this book is address, maybe sort out the happy talk, you know, from that other deep aversion that we have. So let's say it's both things can be true at the same time, that there's a lot of nice messaging out there about failure's value, and that failure is good, and that failure is sort of part of life and part of success. But then there's also messaging out there that says, I'm sorry, failure is not an option, not in the real world, not where I work, you know, whether that's healthcare or aviation or just financial services. People will say things like, well, that's kind of a nice for the Silicon Valley or for, you know, for inventors, but that's not the real world. And so the main point of the book, the main goal of the book, is to sort out when and why and how failure is useful, productive, you know, that's right kind of wrong, and when and why and how we can avoid the wrong kind of wrong. So how do we prevent as many preventable failures as possible? And then how do we welcome and embrace and even pursue as many intelligent failures as possible?
So we're going to come to that. What is an intelligent failure? What is a basic failure? And what do we do with them? And how do we identify them? But I just wondered who you envisage this book being for. Is this book for everyone? Is this book for business leaders, organizations?
No, Hannah, I know it's never the right answer to say this book is for everyone, but this book is for everyone. And in fact, many business leaders or clinicians or you name it are also parents and or parents of young adults or were young adults themselves, right? So there's a message in this book that is quite universal for thriving in your life, in your work. So I think the book can be read by everyone. And possibly will hit you in different ways depending on the lens through which you're reading it.
Also, before we sort of drill down into some of the specific definitions of failure, it's interesting to find out where this sort of came from for you, this fascination with failure.
Well, I think there's two answers to that, you know, and one is that I maybe had an unhealthy dose of wanting to not fail, right? An unhealthy dose of wanting to get only good marks in school and, you know, to be a success. It wasn't that I had particular ambition for my career, but I wanted to be successful and, you know, and do well in school and then find something meaningful to do. So I had a strong dose of that allergy to failure that I think many people, often many sort of high achievers, at least at school age, do have. So it was always one of those things I was uncomfortable with failure for a very long time. But from my research interests and as a person interested in organizations and management and how to make both of those better, I came into this field thinking, we need to help people and organizations become more learning oriented because the world keeps frustratingly changing and organizations don't easily change with it. You know, whether those are government organizations or private sector organizations, we all know that organizational sort of change and learning are hard and are now easily kind of resisted. So my lens on how do we help managers, how do we help leaders was always through this learning frame, right? How do we help organizations learn? And I think it almost goes without saying that one of the things organizations must learn from are their own mistakes and their own failures. And that too turns out to be harder than it should be, particularly for the reason that people don't speak up about their mistakes and their failures. So oftentimes they're not shared widely enough so that the organization can actually learn its lessons and then go forward and do better next time. That can only happen when people are willing and able to speak up with the truth about what's really happening. So I went into this research, you know, many, many years ago, just intrigued by learning, aware that mistakes and failures were part of the learning that needs to happen, but not knowing much more than that. And so even all these years later, I'm still studying learning, but now I'm putting failure center stage.
You said that you had a sort of allergy to failure and you would sort of wanted to work hard and succeed. Do you think that is something that everybody has innately? Or, I mean, this is probably a question for later, but do you think men or women tend to be more perfectionist and more scared of failure? Do you think there's a gender discrepancy?
Well, I think everybody has, you know, sort of a natural or, you know, a hardwired desire to succeed and be thought well of. And your family upbringing, your community, your schools, maybe your, you know, spiritual communities that you might be a part of, they can send variations on that message that are either louder or quieter. So there are differences across people. Now, in terms of gender differences, I think there is research, it's not mine, but there is research that suggests that women are more likely to suffer from perfectionism than men. Like that there are more cultural messages and more ways that you need to be perfect or at least, you know, you need to do well. So I think that is a real issue. And then in work environments, any group that's underrepresented in a particular domain, let's say in senior executive ranks, for instance, will rightly feel more visible as a member of a group, not just as an individual, and thereby have more anxiety about how they may be seen, because it can reflect on their group, not just on them as an individual.
Yeah, really interesting. So you might be more prone to fear of failure if you're feeling more exposed, or you're feeling less like you belong, I suppose.
Absolutely. And you know, and let's be clear, it's not that fear of failure is weird or bad in any, you know, it's good to be a little bit afraid of failure so that we work hard and prevent the things that we can prevent. The biggest issue with fear of failure is that the easiest way to manage it is just don't take risks, right? Don't take the hard courses, you know, don't go for the stretch assignments, because if there's a deep fear that failing would be terrible, then it's very natural and likely to just play not to lose, right? To set less ambitious goals for yourself and maybe for your team as well.
And does modern day society make it worse, sort of enhances the social stigma that comes with failing, particularly social media?
That is my current conclusion, yes. Modern day society is taking some old human wiring and socialization and putting it on steroids with social media. And social media, of course, by offering us curated data, curated images, curated messages from other people's apparently perfect lives, we're even more likely to suffer by comparison. You know, social comparison is nothing new. We've been sort of comparing ourselves to others in the community, to our neighbors, for as long as there have been human beings. And some of that is motivating, right? Some of that makes us want to, you know, be good people and do our part for the community so that others will think well of us. But social comparison with social media is a distorted and by and large unhealthy environment for human beings to navigate.
I was really interested by your comment when you talk about that. You say the real failure is believing others will like us more if we are failure-free. Again, I think something that people are starting to come around to.
I think that's right. And it's, you know, think about a friendship that you have, or, you know, a friend that you've made either long ago or recently. I think you convert from sort of an acquaintance, someone you like and maybe enjoy hanging out with, to a true friend once you're vulnerable with each other. You know, once one of you sort of admits something that is, you know, anxiety provoking or imperfect, or, you know, that you're really worried about, then suddenly there's this sort of instant real connection, a genuine connection that's based on authenticity that just wasn't there before when we're still trying to, you know, look good and come across as a worthy person to be your friend. But as soon as we become authentic, vulnerable, honest, then in fact, we end up liking each other more, not less.
So is that something you actively think should be encouraged in the workplace and everywhere, really? You know, but I suppose specifically in the workplace, because you're already talking about it as something as a basis of friendship and probably family relationships. But that vulnerability is something that could bring a lot to the workplace.
Yes, and not just because it's nice. I mean, it's rewarding and also makes me happier to go to work when I have actual friends at work. You know, when I have people that I can be with at work and be myself and be authentic with, it's just a more engaging, inspiring place to be. But beyond just that, it's about the nature of the work today for most of us is uncertain, interdependent, complex. And we will do better work when we're more honest and open about what's really happening. And so if I'm more able to speak truthfully to you about, I'm falling behind on this, I'm not quite sure where to go with it, or hey, I need help on this, or I think you're making a mistake on that. Right? If we're able to do that more easily, more naturally, then we will do better work together. So maybe my first interest in this is based on the quality of the work, whether that work is financial services or patient care or automotive manufacturing. Our honesty with each other makes for higher quality work outputs.
Right Kind of Wrong is the title. And you mentioned intelligent failure, basic failure. So is, your premise that some types of failure are right and some types of failure are wrong, and that we should only be failing in a certain way, or that we have to fail in all ways?
I don't want to imply a moral judgment, right? Again, sometimes the words right and wrong might imply that. So let me try to be clear when I'm talking about right kind of wrong or intelligent failure. The good kinds of failure are the ones that are valuable. They're useful. They're useful because they bring us new information that we simply couldn't have gotten any other way. And the not so good kinds of failure are, you know, at worst, tragic, and at best, wasteful, right? If I have a failure that could have been avoided if I just used a checklist, for example, and that I lost some time, or maybe I lost a little bit of money, or I lost something as a result, hopefully nothing catastrophic, then that's a waste, right? That's something I could have avoided, and I would have been happier, and you would have been happier. You know, there was no real value that came from that failure.
So an intelligent failure, let's go back to that, and then we can come back to the basic failures.
Sure.
Again. You know, you briefly alluded to it, but in the book, you quite specifically describe what and when a failure is intelligent.
So I'll define an intelligent failure as the undesired result of a thoughtful foray into new territory. The four criteria that I offer in the book are it's in new territory, right? So you couldn't just look it up, get the answer, and easily put that into practice. It's in pursuit of a goal. Whether that goal is, you know, a great new product for your company, or, you know, a life partner, or, you know, joining an ice hockey team. It's in pursuit of a goal. It is informed by prior knowledge. You've done as much as you can to find out what's known here, what's possible here. And then finally, it's as small as possible. It's no bigger. The failure is no bigger than it has to be to get you that next step forward, to get you the new knowledge that you need. So scientific experiments in laboratories, in universities or companies are all about intelligent failure. Of course, they have some successes, too. But that's where the model is, you know, quintessentially a good fit, right? It's in pursuit of a goal, you know, new territory. You've done your homework. You've got a hypothesis. And you don't waste more time, resources than you need to get the new knowledge. So if a failure hits all four of those criteria, then we can call it intelligent, and it brings us something new. Now I'm describing it, and I talk mostly about failures that are really new to the world. But let's say we're just talking about failures that are new to you, like you decide to pick up the game of golf, right? I can almost guarantee that your first contact between the club and the ball will not be pretty, right? It'll be a failure it'll be a basic failure in a technical sense. But for you, there's no way to get good at golf without trying, right? Without being willing to have lots and lots of failures along the way. Every little child who learns to walk or learns to ride a bicycle experiences many failures before they're able to master that new activity. And each of those are intelligent failures because those are new territory for them. You know, they're prepared and ready. They've asked someone, how do you hold this club? Right. And you do as much as you can to increase the chances of success, but you can't produce success every time.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You talk about a lot about sort of scientists and innovators, creators, when you're talking about intelligent failure. But those examples you've just given, children, you talk also about sort of finding a date as well. But does intelligent failure, to look at what it is in essence, do you look to the, and what do you call them?
Elite failure practitioners.
What do they show us to learn from?
Yeah, so elite, I coined that phrase in my head just as almost a joke, right? And then I thought, no, it's pretty good. Like I'm gonna run with it for a little bit. And they are the people, you know, the inventors, the scientists, the Olympic athletes, right? They're the people really at the leading edge of their craft, and that, you know, others would recognize them as well as at the leading edge of some domain. And they are the people who have figured out a way to be okay with their failures, right? Or they wouldn't succeed so brilliantly in their careers or their work. So what do they have in common? Well, you know, they tend to be quite driven. They tend to be unusually curious. I wonder what would happen if, right? There are people who are just driven to kind of turn around that next corner just to see what's there. They almost can't help themselves, or they've trained themselves to be that way. They're resilient, right? Because it is the case that they have had more failures than the rest of us. Even though they're so successful, they've only gotten there by having more failures, more setbacks than those of us who've stayed in sort of safer territory. So that what can we learn from those more extreme examples of very successful people, especially on leading edge of various domains? And I realized, well, they're curious, they're driven, they're resilient, they are ambitious, but they don't take themselves overly seriously. Right? They're when they stumble, they don't try to cover it up and pretend it didn't happen.
Also, they use failure experimentally to learn. So particularly in science, that failure, or those who seem to be those that we would emulate or, you know, seek to be like, are the ones who take the failure and they don't walk away and try and brush it under the carpet. They dwell on it and they react to it and they use it to enhance their lives or to come up with in science, again and again, it's the failure that eventually leads to something wonderful, the eureka moment that you describe.
Exactly right. No, they and not just for themselves, but if they're a scientist nowadays, if you're a scientist, you're not Pasteur alone in his lab. You're in a busy, thriving community of other scientists. And one of the things they do quite well is that they share their failures with each other because they understand the value of others doing that with them, and thereby precluding an intelligent failure happening a second time. Because if I'm a scientist and I have this big failure and this big learning, and I do, as you say, dwell on it and I learn everything I can from it, that's great. But if I can share it with others, then we, the community, will learn from it and ultimately use our resources collectively more wisely and make discoveries that are useful to the world more quickly.
And for smaller failures that aren't in a research lab, the same applies.
I think it does. I mean, think about the usefulness and the pleasure you get from learning that someone else has, you know, had a failure, had a mistake, and they tell you about it, and you think, oh, wow, it's great to hear that. And you resolve not to do the same thing. I mean, it's one of the gifts we can give each other, is to share our failures, particularly to help others avoid the same ones.
Absolutely. So basic failures. The suggestion is, I may have got this wrong, basic failures aren't great. We don't really want to fail in a basic way. Right. So why do you want to include them? What is it that we learn from them?
Well, first of all, I want to include them as a foil, right? So that we have a deeper appreciation for the actual value of intelligent failures, because when we juxtapose them with basic failures and what I'll call complex failures, it becomes easier to see why the intelligent ones truly are different, why they're useful in our lives and in our workplaces, right? But also I include them because I think part of the science of this is learning the best practices for avoiding the avoidable failures, right? For avoiding preventable failures. And so basic failures are defined as failures with a single cause, right? You just make one sort of mistake. You substitute sugar for salt in the recipe, and you know the cookies turn out, or the biscuits turn out to be inedible. And so that's a failure, albeit a small one. But it's not necessary to do that, right? It's by following the recipe, by staying awake, by not texting as you drive. You know, you can prevent many preventable basic failures. So I thought it would be useful to put all in one place, not only the practices to help us get comfortable with the discoveries and advances that come from intelligent failures, but also to be reassured that by following best practices in familiar territory, we don't have to suffer the indignity of basic failures. I'm not saying that when they happen, you should be ashamed. We're all human. We're all fallible. We all, you know, we'll all have basic failures in our lives. But there's certain basic failures we very much want to avoid, again, because they range from wasteful to downright devastating.
So, I mean, is it just being aware of them that enables us to avoid them? Or is it, you know?
No, it's, I mean, some of it's just being aware of them. But more precisely, basic failures are best avoided by a handful of practices, you know, in companies. It's things like basic training, basic safety training, right? When you onboard a new employee, if it's in a dangerous setting, you give them safety training. If it's just a process or a set of activities that they're supposed to execute effectively in their role, you make sure they're trained in them to avoid obvious basic failures of screwing up a customer's account because they didn't get the training they needed. So I know this sounds very basic, but there's sort of foundational practices that help us do that which we know how to do well. Training, practice, you know, checklists, being awake, teamwork, right? Because I might see you about to make a mistake and I'm noticing it so I can say, hey, Hannah, you know, and then you and I together have just avoided a preventable failure. So mundane, this is very mundane stuff, but as you know, it's often missed.
Yes, and it leads to some seriously important and, as you said, sometimes catastrophic failures, which you talk about many examples in the book. But actually, we've got this far without mentioning one of the things which you are highly renowned for, which is, of course, psychological safety. And I wonder if you could just at this point explain that, because that weaves its way through the whole book as being one of the most important ways to avoid failure, both basic and intelligent.
Yeah, thank you. So psychological safety describes an environment where you really believe you can speak up, you know, with maybe somewhat challenging or interpersonally risky things like pointing out someone else's mistake, like I was describing before, or asking for help when you don't know what to do. That can be very hard for people interpersonally at work. And people worry very much what their boss thinks or the people above them in the organization's hierarchy thinks. So psychological safety describes a work environment where you honestly believe you can take the interpersonal risks of speaking up, right? Asking for help, pointing out a mistake, and so on. And this is the kind of climate, you know, that learning organizations, that excellent organizations in any industry try to build so as to avoid basic failures. Right? There's nothing for me more heartbreaking than, say, your NHS, when a patient is harmed in the process of receiving, you know, care, because someone made a mistake that could have been avoided had someone else spoken up in a timely way, right? And so, and that happens in every industry setting you can think of. So psychological safety becomes, I don't want to call it a tool because it's not a tool. It describes an environment where certain behaviors are just easier to engage in than they would otherwise be. There are things that everyone can do to build more psychological safety in organizations. But you can recognize this, I think, clearly as the kind of environment you need to operate safely where there's risk, or to operate in a really learning-oriented, more innovative way when you're trying to be innovative, because you just are less worried about risk-taking.
I mean, you can also encourage psychological safety within the family, in all environments. Can you give maybe some ideas of how, if people are listening to, you know, if they're in a position of being able to encourage that? And it doesn't just have to be leaders, does it? It can be someone in an office who is familiar with the concept, who can try and create that kind of a culture.
Absolutely. So, I mean, and you mentioned families, and it's true. I think, you know, in families with a sort of healthy learning oriented culture, if you will, they're well aware that the risk of the kids being afraid to tell their parents the truth, maybe about something that's going on at school or something that might be happening in their social circle, is a much bigger risk than if the kids felt absolutely able, you know, to speak up early and often when they need help. If they need a ride home, there's something happening at a party and they're teenagers that doesn't feel right to them, they need a ride home, no questions asked. Or they need to have someone to call where they know they won't get yelled at. Oh, I told you not to go to that kind of party again. It's got to be what I call blameless reporting. That's true in families. That's true in work environments. We must not shoot the messengers. We need to do everything we can to encourage people to be open and honest and quick with what they see, what they need, you know, so that we can get on to doing what we need to do, whether it's to keep people safe or to learn, to grow, and to achieve our goals.
I mean, because we do have, don't we, a sort of a blame culture, which doesn't help when it comes to accepting failure. So, you know, we largely like to blame ourselves for everything. And also we often, you know, need a scapegoat. And, you know, you cite lots of examples in the book of individuals who've been blamed where perhaps it wasn't fair to do so. How do we kind of just try and move away from that? Because that seems to me to be something very ingrained.
I love the way you said that. Yes, we do have a blame culture, and we meaning like culturally, society, we have a blame culture. And I think you're absolutely right that one of the ways that manifests is in finger pointing. And it can be finger pointing. I mean, many people have a very quick, you know, almost knee-jerk response if something goes wrong with someone else, like he did it, she did it, right? But other people have that kind of over-responsible, and they erroneously blame themselves. And neither of those explanations of something going wrong are true. Sometimes it is, right? Sometimes someone has really done something blameworthy and problematic, and they should, you know, own it and learn from it and resolve not to do that again. But far more often, the things that go wrong are kind of complex, and they're a combination of factors that come together. And our knee-jerk reaction to blame is not only unhelpful and painful, but it prevents us from learning what we can about the true events leading up to the failure, so that when we go forward, we're wiser and better off as a result.
And also, you write about how, I think to avoid this, you need to appreciate systems to sort of undertake a broader view, step back, this is your words, not mine, and see how something can be part of a bigger system rather than sort of something that we are personally or someone is personally to blame for.
Absolutely. That's, you know, the seventh chapter of the book is about seeing systems and learning to appreciate systems, because we naturally, and our education reinforces this, we naturally look at parts, that we look at elements, and we've been trained to kind of go very deep and be very interested in the parts and less aware of the relationships between the parts. But the behaviors of most systems, and indeed the behaviors of most failures, are caused by the relationships between parts more than the parts themselves. You know, it's rarely just some little bit is wholly responsible for the breakdown. There's usually the ways in which the different bits didn't fully align, or we didn't understand the ways they were going to relate to each other, that will give rise to the failure.
Hello, it's Vas here, recommending you a new book from our friends at Firm Press. This May, the author of The Argonauts and other genre-defying, unclassifiable modern classics, Maggie Nelson, is back with a new collection of essays. It's called Like Love. The collection celebrates art, artists, and thinkers, including Prince, Bjork, Sarah Lucas, and Judith Butler. Like Love is available to pre-order now in hardback, ebook, and audio.
So how do you encourage people to sort of appreciate systems, which your words, not mine?
You know, I encourage it through curiosity, right? Through sort of inviting people to step back and take the broader look at that some goal or program or activity that they're involved in. Let's say you're creating a new company, you're in a startup, or you're in a new project, and we're so focused on, oh, let's make progress. Like, we have deadlines. We gotta just keep moving forward, that we can often, the old saying, go slow to go fast. It's like, sometimes we're just moving so fast and we're so busy that we fail to take that little bit of time we needed to kind of step back and see what's really going on here and notice a better way, notice a better path. So the simple doorway into systems thinking is to pause for a moment and say, who else and what else might be affected by this action or this decision? And then what might happen later as a result of doing this now? Because systems thinking is kind of the discipline to move from me now to us and later, right? To have a larger view.
Yeah, that was just a fascinating learning from the book about temporal discounting, this to move away from our temptation to think only in the now, as you mentioned just there. But as a result, we're very bad at doing things like making sure that our car is, you know, preventative medicine and all of that. You know, again, you encourage us to really try and move away from that mindset and to be better, I suppose, yes, at thinking of future failures and doing all we can now to avoid them. But I think it's a human trait, certainly one I recognize, the difficulty of caring about that until it's too late.
Right. A temporal discounting refers to our natural tendency to value rewards and events that are happening right now more than what might happen later in the future. And so it's what leads us to sort of have that second piece of chocolate cake, which just because it's delicious, and not sort of pause to think, well, but you know, this might not be such a good idea for health or whatever. So, but that's of course just a trivial example. It's very natural. I think we can almost describe wisdom, and you know, little children are of course just perpetually right here, right now. They want what they want, and we try to help them. We try to help them learn and grow, and learn patience, and learn delayed gratification, and learn to see others, that others' needs are as valid and important as their own, and to become a sort of part of a community with mutual respect and mutual valuing. And one could describe wisdom as just a, sort of that slow process of developing as much, you know, more and more awareness that others' needs matter as much as your own, and that the future matters as much as the present, right? That we need to sometimes really pause and think carefully about whether this is the right thing to do right here, right now, even though it feels like something that would be effective or fun to do. And that's, you know, that's a never ending learning journey, I think.
And that's essentially changing our ways of thinking to avoid future failure.
Yes, and it's often a team sport, right? It's if you're serious about, say there's some policy you want to put into your company, or there's some activity you want to engage in, you know, if you're serious about thriving over the longer period, most of the time you really do need to get some other voices into the conversation, right? If it's something really new and different and potentially important, just take the time to sort of run it by some people. What do you think here? You know, get some people from different backgrounds or different areas of expertise, because predicting the future is not, you know, not easy, not natural, but it's better done with the inclusion of different perspectives.
I'm going to take a question from the audience now and then come back to some of my own if I have time. But Megan says, I teach at a primary school in year 5 and 6, and there's such a sense of fear of failure from the children that limits them in taking risks. What advice would you give to allow them to know that risk-taking and failure is a positive, and failure is something they should be comfortable with? Great question, Megan. Thank you.
It is a great question. And you know, I wonder, Megan, whether this has become harder for those kids and harder for people, you know, teachers like you over the past decade or so, or whether it's always been this way. But I think that it may be harder. I think what you're talking about may be harder as those young children are so much more aware than certainly I was at their age of people they're seeing online. You know, they're just exposed to a great deal more. And so they're potentially more anxious about failure, about getting it wrong. I'm a huge fan of the work on growth mindset, and I think it can be. So I think there's two powerful factors or ways to help you help them, which is one, get yourself familiar with growth mindset and that deep understanding developed by the researcher Carol Dweck that the children who understand their abilities as like muscles, right? Their cognitive abilities, their athletic abilities, when they understand that those are abilities that get stronger and better with work, with practice, you know, with failures, versus the ones who think they have some kind of innate talent that's fixed, the fixed mindset. Those kids, and they are the dominant, it's the dominant group, it's the dominant mindset, the fixed mindset, they are reluctant, like you're describing, to take any risks. And then they harm themselves. In other words, they by not taking risks, they are limiting their own potential for advancement, for growth, for wisdom, right? So it's about helping them and you appreciate that, in fact, their capability is limitless to a certain extent, right? As long as they're willing to stretch and to have failures along the way, they'll actually be helping themselves get, you know, better and smarter all the time. Try to keep the phones and the social media out of it, so that we're not so in the perpetual now. That gosh, I don't want to have anything that's less than perfect today. Well, that just won't work, especially if you're, you know, a 10-year-old or 11-year-old child. You've got to be, you know, if you're not stretching and struggling and solving hard problems today, that's going to be really a problem. You know, the other thing I would add is just help them see. And I think there's so many biographies and articles in the media and elsewhere about how really effective people, whether those in history, you know, like Thomas Edison just always comes to mind because he has this wonderful quote, "I haven't failed. I found 10,000 ways that won't work," right? In the pursuit of the electric light bulb, for example. But help them see that the most successful people in every field have failed more, not less, than the rest of us. Right? That's what true achievement and true success looks like, that willingness to fail along the way.
Do you think we need to do something about the language? Because we have such binary language, failure and success, and very little words that we use in between.
Yeah, we can say a miss. Some things are a mishap. Other things are a disappointment. Other things are just a pure discovery. I didn't know that could happen, right? And they all fit under the umbrella category failure. But I think you're right, Hannah. Like being, I don't want to encourage double speak, or, you know, the kind of language that then reinforces the idea that it's sort of shameful. Like, let's just talk about, like, we can talk about it. It's okay, right? It's okay to fail. Like, let's not think about fail as a word with a capital F, right? A word that, you know, I am a failure. No, I failed, right? I had a disappointment. I didn't do well on that test. I didn't win that running race. Those are all, in a sense, undesired negative results, but they're not shameful in any way. I couldn't have failed to win that race unless I entered it. I mean, the easiest way to never fail is just to never do anything. But that creates a whole other risk, which is, you know, the risk of stagnation and never getting anywhere.
Yeah. No, I remember somebody's bio, someone rather well known, just describes himself as a work in progress, which is essentially, you know, what we all should be.
That's right. And that's the growth mindset, really. It's a lovely way to put it. I'm a work in progress. Someone I worked for many years ago, Buckminster Fuller, said, I seem to be a verb. Right? I'm not a noun, I'm a verb, you know, meaning the action, right? That it's sort of, it's a never ending journey of doing and being and learning and hopefully growing.
Well, Arnie says, not a question, but a quote. Nelson Mandela said, don't judge me by my successes, but how many times I fell and got up again. Thank you.
Right,
and
right.
Actually, yeah, we haven't mentioned also complex failures. We've talked about intelligent ones, basic ones. Perhaps you could explain complex failures, what they are, where we should look for them and avoid them.
Complex failures are on the rise. They happen because of the complexity of our systems and our lives. And they are defined as failures caused by multiple factors, any one of which on its own would not have caused a failure. But the perfect storm, the way they all came together, led to a failure. So many failures, sort of classic failures, fit the bill. In the UK, many, many, many years ago, the Torrey Canyon, which was an oil spill in 1967, 13 million gallons of crude oil spilled off the Isle of Scilly. Right? And that was a complex failure. It was about eight different small, you know, unimportant small factors that came together just the wrong way and led the ship to collide with the rocks and have this catastrophic accident. So the NASA shuttle failures that I've studied in depth, both of them, Columbia and Challenger, are complex failures. It's just many little things that line up in just the wrong way. Many adverse drug events in hospital care are complex failures. Again, nobody made one big giant mistake that led to the failure. It's that a few things were just slightly off in ways that ordinarily you would have gotten away with it. But because of them all coming together at the wrong time, in the wrong way, we get to a failure. So undesired, sometimes, again, sometimes very small and sometimes very large.
And how do people who aren't in those sorts of scenarios, because the ones that you describe, as you've just mentioned then, and the many others in the book, are quite specific to large organizations, or as you know, you talk about NASA and ships. But what about people listening who are that's far removed from their everyday life? But what do they learn from a complex failures?
Yeah, I mean, there are complex failures in your life. You know, you forget to charge your cell phone, and you. You know, you leave the house a little late and then the phone dies and there's more traffic than you expected. Any one of those things on their own wouldn't have led you to be kind of catastrophically late for some meeting that really mattered in your work or personal life. And then that led to, you know, not something bad happening that could have been avoided. And let's say you missed the flight, you know, and we've all had, again, not catastrophic, but Let's say it's something that in your life or in your work is deeply undesired, and you absolutely know, but it wasn't just one thing. It was just these many little things. Now, could you have avoided it? Yes, of course you could. And the way you avoid them is by vigilance and mindfulness, right? And speaking up. Again, many complex failures, I think both the smaller and the larger, could have been avoided had someone spoken up in a timely way to just altering even one of those factors would have prevented the failure. It's almost like sometimes we're just doing too much and we're too busy and we're doing some of it in our sleep, if you will. And if we can just take a deep breath and say, what do I, you know, be present, thinking about what do I really need to do and where do I need to be, and then do those things as well as we can, that will prevent many, many complex failures. But if you're in an organization where complex failures are possible, then your main contribution and your main reason for understanding this phenomenon is because you might be the person who spoke up, you know, at just the right time and in a way that ends up preventing something bad from happening.
It strikes me a lot of modern day society, digital doing everything, you know, fast social media, as we've discussed, obviously a lot of negatives. But I wonder, you know, can it be used as a force for good when it comes to failing and to learning from failure? Are there sort of parts of our digital world that can really help?
Well, I think when people share their experiences honestly and more widely than if, you know, maybe in another era, we could have only shared them with people we knew face to face, and people on our team or in our family or in our community. Whereas social media, sometimes we're reading the stories of people who live on the other side of the world whom we would have never met, and gaining some insight, some secondhand knowledge, some secondhand learning from them. So I think that is the potential upside.
And do you think the pandemic has influenced, for good or for worse, for better or for worse, our ability to maybe accept failure? I mean, how has that influenced things? As no doubt it has, the work culture's changed considerably since then. I wonder what you've noticed that has changed in terms of the culture of failure.
Well, there's probably some, I mean, I know there are some wonderful benefits that have come from the discovery, for example, the discovery that we could, or many of us, almost overnight, learn how to do things we did not know how to do before, like teach our classes over Zoom or what have you. So that learning about that agility and flexibility and opportunity to learn new skills and do things really differently, things that we thought were not doable in a different way, that I think has been an enormous opportunity, to celebrate the possibility of doing things in new ways. That's been a plus, and it's been a kind of wide set of distributed experiments that are changing how we work, and some of that in positive ways. At the same time, one of the aftermaths of COVID is that the bonds of our relationships that really are nurtured in when we're really in meaningful contact with each other have been harmed a little, and in some cases severed by lack of sort of meaningful, honest conversation together of the kind that proximity really helps and nurtures. Our sense of being connected to each other, of true caring about each other, is a little bit under attack when we're always working virtually or at a distance.
Yeah, really interesting. We'll just end off with another audience question. Just wondering, and we've sort of touched on this, but what's the best way, if you are a leader or even a parent or in this scenario, to encourage people after a failure to not judge? What's the best way to speak to someone in that scenario?
With empathy, with curiosity, and with a forward-looking lens. So I think one of the best question, the question to ask any group and maybe any individual, is what happened, right? Just let's dig into what happened as if it were a story, right? As if it were a narrative rather than a, you know, it's not a judgment. We want to describe as best we can what happened so that you can learn, I can learn, and we can together think about what next, right? So it's all about having the empathy to know, well, this is probably not fun for you in this moment, but let's dig into what happened and then let's look forward together.
And is that the same way in which you should speak to yourself to prevent yourself from beating yourself up after a failure?
Yes, absolutely. You know, in chapter 5 of Right Kind of Wrong, I talk about a little model that I use that I find very powerful, which is stop, challenge, choose. And, you know, we have a tendency, or at least I do, to catastrophize, right? So something, you know, I missed a meeting. It's the end of the world. It's not, right? Just pause, breathe, you know, stop, challenge your initial race up the ladder to, you know, this is terrible. No, it's not terrible. It's inconvenient or disappointing, right? And give yourself better language to confront the shortcoming in a productive way, again, to learn and grow and prevent the same kind of thing happening, but putting, we often refer to this as putting it into perspective. But I think sometimes that's very clinical language. It's just challenge your initial thinking and choose a healthier, more productive, more learning oriented response instead.
So just to end, we've had that lovely quote, thanks to Arnie, but you have so many brilliant quotes in your book. I wonder if you might be able to just end with perhaps your favourite, or you can choose two if you like.
Okay.
It's peppered with so many quotes, which are very inspirational and so instructive.
So maybe I'll start with Winston Churchill. Success is stumbling from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. And I think that's right, in any field of endeavor. But let me end with Louisa May Alcott, the 19th century novelist, who says, I am not afraid of storms, for I'm learning how to sail my ship. I think the future for all of us is full of storms, you know, literal and metaphorical. And we must help ourselves not be afraid of them, but learn to navigate them. And this is something we can and must do together. There will be failures, but let's sail our ships as best we can through these storms.
Very good place to end, particularly with Louisa May Alcott. I highly approve. So thank you very much to everyone for signing in. And Amy, thank you hugely for giving us your time. It's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode starred Amy Edmondson and was presented by Hannah McInnes. The producer was Sam Elgranti, and I make the show with Nicole Wong. Our editor is John Doughty. If you enjoyed it, consider subscribing to How To Plus, where you can not only get access to our whole livestream program for free, you can also listen to our exclusive members-only podcast channel and hear everything weeks or even months ahead of the public release. You can also gift How To Plus membership to friends and loved ones this Christmas. Find out more on our website. Till next time, I'm Vass Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.